This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Luke Ford. Luke, it's nice having you back on the show.
Hey, Robert, good to be here.
So where we left off last time is we were planning out the event, the upcoming event at the time at the Gem Center in Beverly Hills. And I posted the YouTube videos of that event up on my site, and you had it up in your site. What was your opinion of the overall event, and what were some of the responses that you got from that event?
Well, like all first dates, it was awkward because it was like a combination of the white nationalists and some Jews, such as myself, who also identify as white nationalists. But let's face it, most white nationalists do not like Jews. So this was an event held at a Jewish cultural center. And the primary speaker was Tom Sunik, who is not Jewish and who is very well known in European nationalist circles. So it was the thing even just took place was quite something, and there was a good and lively discussion. I'm sure it was awkward for all parties, but it was a beginning to hear different points of view and to have a genuine dialogue.
Yeah, I would say, in a sense, it was a groundbreaking event, even though it was relatively small. Usually when you have events, it's usually like-minded people getting together and basically like preaching to the choir. Even though it was small, I think what I found remarkable about it is you had people from different perspectives and different backgrounds getting together and discussing things in a civil manner.
Yes.
But it was, I sense that what you're saying, there was a certain awkwardness to it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I find it easiest to articulate my own experience. As a Jew, I recognize that most white nationalists do not like Jews and are even genocidal towards them. So to identify as a white nationalist as a Jew is a very tricky thing, or to even, you know, be sympathetic towards white nationalism is a very tricky thing. And then for your non-Jewish white nationalist, Jews are the enemy, generally speaking. So it's very challenging to bring these two sides together. And so, I mean, there are maybe 30 people or so in the audience, but the main audience is going to be online. And so one 40-minute video I posted from the discussion received 1,500 views. Other videos received 300 or 400 views. So the main audience will be online. And it was an opening. It was a beginning.
Yeah, I know it was primarily, Sunik was planning to speak on the issue of Islam and the Islamization of Europe. That was primarily Sunik's speech. Then Charles Lincoln had his own sort of idea of a detente. That was more of Charles Lincoln's idea, but he didn't speak at the event really. He had a role in setting it up, but that was kind of his idea. What was your thoughts on that? Basically, on creating a detente between two groups that usually are perceived to basically hate each other's guts.
Yeah, like I find it easiest to be without an agenda, and so I understand and respect that was Charles's mission, was to have this opening meeting of a possible detente between white nationalists and Jews with sympathies in that direction. For me, it's more important to just articulate and describe whatever is reality as I see it, without trying to bring things about. That I am by nature not an organizer. I'm just someone who sees reality in a certain way and is able to articulate that. So for me, it was an honor just to listen to Tom Sunik and to talk to him, particularly the opportunity to talk with him privately, both before the event and after the event. and through Tom Sunic, I can then talk to everyone who matters in nationalist circles, because everyone who matters in European nationalism, Tom Sunic knows. So whether it's the Popular Front or Golden Dawn in Greece, or the British National Party, or any of the various nationalist movements in Europe, Tom Sunic is connected or knows them. And so through him, I can talk to all these different European nationalist movements. So that's what I found most gratifying.
Well, you're relatively new to a lot of this stuff, so you're saying you're not well connected with that movement.
Correct. I'm relatively new. I'd say about 6 months. About 6 months ago, I came out as a white nationalist, in the same sense that I'm also a Jewish nationalist and a Zionist. But I've also been exploring these themes in my blogging for 16 years. Like, since 1999, I've been saying that what Jews want for themselves through Zionism and the creation of their own state, I would want that for all peoples, including white peoples, and that just Jews have group interests, so should non-Jewish whites have group interests, and they should try to further them and further the creation of their own nation states. So it's been a journey, because, as you know, it's such an unpopular thing to say that. I've kind of been on the margins of it, and generally I've just been, sympathetic to right-wing perspectives. And then only in the last 6 months have I kind of given up all my hopes for mainstream success, and saying, okay, let me just say what I really think and believe, and let me just
Yeah,
throw in my
I think I
lot.
said it last time, but you had more respect in the mainstream when you were blogging about porn.
Yeah, like once you identify with white nationalism, that's the death sentence to any kind of social acceptance or success. I mean, so many jobs are now closed to you. You will be a figure of opprobrium. You will never receive acclaim. You will never receive social status. You've all sorts of doors just close once you identify with white nationalism.
And how much, but I've noticed you haven't, I haven't seen that much of a reaction online to you becoming a white nationalist. Have you gotten any hostility yet?
Yeah, I've had quite a few Jewish acquaintances call me a Nazi. So I've had my share of hostility, but once you show that you cannot be intimidated, and once it's known that you make an independent income, that you're not dependent on any one source for your income, and therefore you cannot be destroyed as easily as, say, if I worked for the Los Angeles Unified School District, or if I worked for UCLA, or if I worked for a movie studio or a television production company, I would be much easier to destroy than as an independent Alexander Technique teacher. So there's much less of a target that I can present. There's fewer things that the Southern Poverty Law Center can do to destroy my life.
A good point is, what is your theory why those two groups that you mentioned, Jews and white nationalists, despise each other so much?
Wow. So the organized Jewish community has seen that Jewish safety relies upon a weakened form of national, religious, and racial bonds on the part of the non-Jews. So Jewish intellectual movements, as Kevin MacDonald has described, have sought to discredit nationalism, have sought to discredit a very strong Christianity that denies religious legitimacy to other points of view, and have sought to discredit the whole notion of race. So, for instance, every major Jewish organization supports immigration amnesty, and that includes the Orthodox Union and Agudas Yisrael, which is a very right-wing Orthodox group. So organized Jewry is
just saying even the most right-wing groups still support
immigration amnesty, which is, from my perspective, it's a death sentence for America. It's the destruction of white America. And organized Jewry has played this huge role in pushing for third world immigration since 1965, for banning prayer in public schools, particularly Christian prayer, trying to discredit the whole notion of race and therefore any racial solidarity, for saying that anyone who talks about group interests on the part of whites is a Nazi, and throwing these kind of slurs around. That has been the behavior of organized Jewry. So when I come out as someone who's sympathetic to white nationalism, I have to then oppose pretty much the entire group establishment of my adopted people, as I am a convert to Orthodox Judaism. Now, many Orthodox Jews agree with my views. Pretty much every Orthodox Jew that I know is a race realist. So organized Jewry doesn't reflect the general views of Orthodox Jews in particular. But, I've got a cop to it, to the destruction that organized Jewry has done to traditional beliefs in white racial identity, traditional beliefs in a white America, and organized Jewry has done such damage in pushing for third world immigration and immigration amnesty. Now, it may very well be that whites and Jews perhaps they just have diametrical interests, and that they're just doomed to tragic conflict. I hope that is not the case, but it may very well be.
That would certainly put you in an awkward position.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a very awkward position anyway, so it's an awkward place. But there's actually an excellent book on these themes by someone who's a veteran anti-racism crusader, a left-wing Jew, but he's actually very insightful. And it was a book that was reviewed on Kevin McDonald's website, The Occidental Observer, and it's called Blood and Politics, The History of the White Nationalist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream by Leonard Zisken, came out in 2009. And it traces the development of white nationalism in America over the last 40 years and points out there's kind of this one outcrop that is not unfriendly to Jews, and that's American Renaissance and Jared Taylor. So this is like the one exception. Other than that, white nationalists, seem to really hate Jews. But Jared's organization even attracts some Jews. And so this book kind of examines what's really going on here. And the book notes that Jared is best friends with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review, which is critics call a Holocaust denial organization. That's not how they see themselves, and I wouldn't use that, but they are Holocaust revisionists. They do challenge traditional narratives regarding the Holocaust, and they are, highly skeptical of Jewish influence on America and the effect of organized Jewry on white America. So Jared has many ties to people who have negative views of Jews. The basic white nationalist position is that Jews are a curse, and they need to be eliminated or certainly expelled. Well, different groups have different interests, and so it may well be the interests of white people and the interests of Jews are just irreconcilable, and these two groups are doomed to irreconcilable conflict and tragedy.
So you don't think, as back to what Charles Lincoln was the idea of a detente, you think that's very unlikely? You think some conflict, major conflict between those two groups is inevitable, or one group becomes dominant and the other group will become either marginalized or wiped out? You don't see any, you think the chance of a peaceful coexistence is very small?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I see both sides. Like, I really hope that a strong white non-Jewish identity in a strong white America and a strong white England and a strong white Europe can emerge. And I hope this would also be a good place for Jews. But that may not be possible. Like, I'm not going to declare either way. Obviously, I want whites to have everything that the Jews have, and I want the same for blacks and for Latinos and for the Chinese and Japanese. I want all peoples to be able to establish their own states and develop their own destinies without interference from outsiders. So I'm a nationalist for everyone. But, you know, there may well be a lot of conflict and tragedy coming along with that.
Yeah, there's that there's basically that concept of can you have nationalism for everyone? And I think you can, but there's always going to be situations where conflict is inevitable. I mean, I think to give examples of that, one example would be like the conflict between the Israel and the Arabs, where they both have claim to the same land. And the other issue would be if nationalists were to come into power in, say, Europe or United States, would there have to be mass expulsions? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if there was regarding Israel and the Arabs, until one side is absolutely dominant, there's going to be conflict, because as long as both peoples can compete, then Jews are going to outcompete the Arabs because of their superior IQ and superior ethnic solidarity, and that's going to be just way too humiliating for the Arabs to deal with, so they will just constantly send suicide bombers or bombs or try to militarily disrupt the state of Israel until they can destroy it and drive it out of its midst, because as long as the Jewish state is there, the Arabs look really, really bad by comparison. So unless Israel comes to just totally dominate the Middle East so that the Arabs and the Muslims are afraid to do battle with them, there's going to be conflict there. Now, if white nationalists come to power in the United States, yeah, there's going to be, I would suspect there would probably be mass expulsions, or the alternatives to that would be to limit areas where, say, blacks could live or Latinos could live.
And within white nationalism, there's different degrees. On one end, you have the most moderate faction of white nationalism. They're saying just have an immigration moratorium and kind of keep the status quo with an immigration moratorium. Then the most extreme level is you have someone like William Pierce, who was an advocate for genocide. And then there's different degrees in between that. You have segregationists. So there's different levels of it. I don't think it's a totally monolithic group. But you had that post of what would happen if they were to take power in the United States.
Yeah, I think that there would be a lot of people who'd be expelled, driven out, you know, at the point of a gun, if necessary.
What would your status be in a white nationalist America? Would you be expelled, or would you be in a position of power, or for basically the status quo?
I'm not at all sure. I think there's a very good chance I could be expelled. There's a chance that I and my people could be executed. And there's a chance that we would be allowed to have our culture and way of life within the rubric of a white nationalist America, you know, with the law enforcement using racial profiling. So that, for instance, there are certain crimes that Jews are not predisposed to. Jews don't tend to commit a lot of rape. You know, they don't tend to commit a lot of armed robbery. They don't tend to commit a lot of murder. But then there are other crimes that Jews commit at little higher rates, such as the more complicated financial crimes, We've had the problems of Jewish spies in America handing our secrets over to the Soviet Union or to Israel. So I think a white nationalist government would very smartly use racial profiling so that I believe already Jews in who have anything to do with the national security interests of the United States receive far more scrutiny than non-Jews. And I think that's probably a good thing because so many Jews have more loyalty to their fellow Jews overseas and to the Jewish people as a whole or to the state of Israel than they do to the particular non-Jewish land that they may happen to be residing in. So, but I think we'd see much more aggressive racial profiling, which would totally make sense. So there are certain crimes that the blacks committed higher rates. There are certain crimes that Jews committed higher rates. And, Latinos have their predilections too. And so I think law enforcement would take common sense precautions against that. Also, there'd probably be homelands in a white nationalist state where say most blacks would not be allowed to leave, you know, without special permits. And you probably have forced sterilizations because, you know, so much of our problems in society come from people with the lowest 20% of IQ. So if you could simply ensure that those people don't have kids, most of our problems as a society would be solved. Most of our problems of crime, of welfare, of just social pathology would be solved if we could ensure that the lowest 20% in IQ do not reproduce. You know, white people have a obligation to better their society. And this was the dominant thinking prior to the Nazis in both the United States and England and in Northern Europe. This eugenics policy was very popular among intellectuals and was put into practice much more in the United States, England, and Northern Europe than it ever was by Nazi Germany. So Nazi Germany adopted it to a small extent, and then Jewish intellectuals then tarred it as being a Nazi program. And so eugenics is now a dirty word, but to me, eugenics is common sense.
And I know about Germany, you had a post about the recent marches in Germany that happened around Christmas.
Yes.
And what is your, were you surprised by that? Because, I mean, in L.A., it was impressive the numbers of people out there, because in L.A., you would never see that in California. I mean, even the protest against illegal immigration in Marietta were nothing. The size of them was impressive.
No, I think it's wonderful to see Germany wake up and to start asserting its white group interests and to rebel against Islam. Islam is not compatible with Germany. Islam is not compatible with the West. Islam is directly hostile to the West and to the welfare of Germany. And so it's great to see Germany start to wake up and to assert itself. And I only hope that they just go from strength to strength. Like, the presence of millions of Turks in Germany is an abomination for that country. It's a terrible thing. And having millions of Muslims in their midst is a horrible thing for Germany. So as a Jew, I would not want millions of Turks moving to Israel, and I would not want millions of Muslims moving in. I would want Israel to remain a Jewish state. So if I want that for my people to be able to determine their own destiny, I also want that for other people such as Germans. Why can't they establish their own state and expel people who are hostile to them? And Muslims are hostile to Germany and to what being German represents.
Do you believe that non-Europeans should be expelled out of Europe?
Yeah, basically. I mean, you could certainly make exceptions for the more valuable ones, such as perhaps some doctors and some highly accomplished people. But yeah, generally speaking, Africans and Muslims have they're hostile to what Europe's all about, like the massive rates of rape that go up whenever you have African immigrants, whether they're immigrants to Minnesota or to Europe. They're an absolute disaster. Islam is totally incompatible with Western civilization. Muslims are you know, hostile to what Western European civilization is all about. So why would you not want to get rid of a hostile people in your midst? And yeah, if there are Jews who are bent on revolutionary causes, whether they be communism or pushing for more third world immigration, I would expel them as well.
So you're saying they should be dealt with on an individual basis if they're...
Well, generally speaking,
generally
speaking, you don't need African immigrants or Muslims in Europe or the United States. They're a disaster. And then you also have a right to expel any individual who's working against the interests of the country, say by promoting third world immigration. I would be fine if they took all the people, the leaders of the immigration amnesty movement, and just shot them as traitors. Like, I think these people are traitors to the United States of America, and I would be fine if the top 500 leaders of them were just lined up against the wall and shot because they're dedicated on destroying this country.
So you're talking about, like, the leaders of the Jewish organizations as well?
Yeah, anyone who is out there actively leading the fight for immigration amnesty for the millions of people who came here illegally and who wants to make them legal, thereby encouraging millions more people to come from the third world or the second world here illegally. They are bent on the destruction of the United States of America. They are traitors to the United States of America. And I'd be happy to see them lined up against the wall and shot, whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish.
And it's also, I mean, also a lot of, there's a lot of different groups. Basically all the corporate CEOs, the leaders of the Catholic Church. I mean, I know that the Lutheran Church was responsible for bringing in a lot of the Somalis into what's it called, into Minnesota.
Yeah.
So it's basically the entire American establishment and elite in this country wants that.
Well, many of them just go along. You know, so like the leaders of these Orthodox Jewish groups that have nominally signed on for immigration amnesty, I've never seen them actually campaigning for it. You know, they don't really bother me. I wish they weren't even nominally signed on, but they're doing nothing to promote immigration amnesty. They're simply allowing their names to be used because they want to have solidarity with their fellow Jewish organizations. But if you're an active promoter and you're out there campaigning for immigration amnesty, you are actively campaigning for the destruction of the United States of America.
So you're saying most of your friends who are Orthodox, they're not in favor of all that stuff.
Yeah, most Orthodox Jews are not in favor of third world immigration. Most Orthodox Jews, you know, are opposed to immigration amnesty. Most Orthodox Jews have no interest in civil rights for sodomites, for trannies, for blacks or Latinos. They find all that stuff an abomination.
What's your opinion of someone like a Sheldon Adelson, who he gives billions, a lot of money to the Republican Party, and pushes them in a direction to support? He pushes the Republican Party to support amnesty. What's your opinion of someone like Sheldon Adelson?
Yeah, I think he's an absolute disaster. I think he's horrific. So, to the extent that he pushes for immigration amnesty, and he seems to have done quite a bit of that, I think he's a traitor to the United States of America. And to the extent that he pushes Israel as in the United States, the United States foreign policy should be particularly friendly and involved in what's going on in Israel, I think that's an absolute disaster. If the United States hadn't been so intricately involved in Israel, I don't think the United States would have been attacked on 9/11. So I think these politicians that American politicians that are constantly talking about involving the United States in Israel and in the Middle East, I think it's against the interests of the United States. The United States should back out of the Middle East and let Israel and the Palestinians and the Egyptians sort out their own destiny. It's been nothing but a heartache and a disaster for the United States. So I think Sheldon Adelson is just so wrong on so many levels.
And I remember with Jared Taylor actually said that after 9/11 happened.
Yeah, Jared Taylor pointed out that the United States probably would not have been hit on 9/11 if it hadn't been so involved with Israel. So I want Israel to act in its national self-interest and to deal with the Palestinians as they need to. And I want the United States to act in its national self-interest. Now, I'm a Jew. I really care about the Jewish state as well as I care about the American state, but I don't want American politics and American best interests compromised by their support of Israel. Let America choose its foreign policy on the basis of what's good for America, not on the basis of what's good for the Jewish state.
And you have a post, you have a post saying, "I rarely think about Palestinian suffering." What was the context of that post?
I don't remember exactly, but it was just like a realization that I had that I rarely think about Palestinian suffering. I don't lose sleep over the approximately 800,000 Palestinians who were kind of pushed out of what is now the nation of Israel in 1948 when Israel was established as a Jewish state. So it's not because I think that they're less human than I am. It's not because I think they're less valuable to God. It's just that I care. I have a strong in-group identity. Whenever you have a strong in-group identity, you tend not to care very much about out-groups. So I don't expect Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims to give a toss about Jewish suffering and about the Holocaust or anything like that either.
Your position is extremely honest. You basically say every group has a right to pursue its group interest. What I sort of dislike about many supporters of Israel is they take this hyper-moralistic stance that the whole world should be obligated to support them. Europeans should be moral, Germans should be morally blackmailed to support Israel. But basically, what you're saying is every group has a rational position to support their own group. Arabs are rational to support their cause. Everyone is rational to support their own people. That's basically your main point, which I agree
Yeah,
with.
and I don't expect people with a strong in-group identity to care about people outside the group. It may be nice, but in the end, we're all in a brutal conflict for resources and for perpetuating our own group. And so, whether Israelis are nice to Palestinians or whether Palestinians are nice to Israelis, whether Jews and Muslims get along and hold, meetings where they discuss, theology and what they have in common, doesn't really matter much. In the end, in the Middle East, one group is going to triumph and one group is going to be humiliated.
And back to what you were saying about a white nationalist takeover, is you say is a white nationalist takeover in the United States inevitable? Most people I see are very pessimistic. They say that America is basically what I get from most people, that basically America is going to look like Southern California and there's nothing anyone can do about it. You don't entirely agree with that in this post.
Yeah, of course, I go back and forth. I certainly have my weeks and months of pessimism and depression about the history of the United States. But actually, it was reading this book by this anti-racism campaigner who is a total enemy of white nationalists. But he makes the point that he thinks there's a very good chance that white nationalists could take over the United States of America. And that cheered me up to no end. So I see both sides. So I do think there is a chance that, for instance, if the grid went down, electricity went out, and we had a brutal Darwinian battle for the survival of the fittest, if we really did have a race war in the United States of America, I have no doubt who would win. Whites would win. And if there was another 9/11 type attack, I think American whites might wake up even more to their group interests and how other groups are either hostile or in the way of white civilization. So yeah, I think there is a chance of a white nationalist takeover, and the vote, for instance, the privilege of voting might be restricted just to whites or to white men who own property, because the current regime cannot last.
Yeah, I see. For Europe, I'm more optimistic about Europe. I'm fairly pessimistic about the United States, but you could be surprised. I mean, you've seen that with Things go in pendulums. I think whites have gone in a sort of a strongly anti-racist direction in the later part of the 20th century. I think for two reasons. I think partially as a reaction to the big events in the 20th century, like the civil rights movement and what happened in World War II, but also because of the extreme prosperity. But you could see the pendulum go the other way as the white middle class is destroyed economically. They won't have the luxury of separating themselves, and they'll be forced to deal with these issues. Is that so? It's hard to predict the future, but you could see massive change like that.
Yeah, like how long will whites put up with really bad service at the post office? And when you go to the post office, it's usually blacks who are serving you. And sometimes they're very good, very friendly, very efficient. But most of the time, it's a horrible experience to go into the post office. So when there are white people who need jobs, like why are we giving jobs and generous benefits to people, many of whom are terrible workers who are slack and inefficient and deliver really poor product, really poor customer service, when there are whites who could be very efficient carrying out that work. So, I sometimes wonder, if whites are ever going to wake up to that. Are they ever going to wake up and get tired of the high rate of their own daughters being raped by Muslims, being raped by blacks, and being raped by illegal Latino immigrants? Will they ever wake up and say enough is enough? We need to realize that civil rights for blacks was an absolute disaster, not just for white people, but for America as a whole and for blacks. Seeing the disintegration of the black family, and blacks tended to behave much better when they lived in Jim Crow segregation and separation, and they felt the boot of the white man much more on their neck. They had more family stability, they had lower rates of crime, they had greater ethnic solidarity. They were doing much better in almost every statistical measurement during the Jim Crow era than in the post-civil rights era. So I do hope that people will wake up.
And also, we touched on this before with the Middle East. Oh yeah, the Jerrod Taylor comment. Why you? So you did. This is where you got that from. Why does the United States choose sides in the Middle East? So basically, what you're saying is that we should stay out of that region.
Yeah, we should stay out of that region unless there's some pressing national interest. I don't think we have to militarily intervene to get oil because they can only make money if they sell the oil. So I think we should just stay out of the Middle East and let all these different tribes fight it out, be it my tribe or other tribes. It's none of the United States' business how big the land of Israel gets, or even Israel's survival should be up to Israelis. It's not the responsibility of the United States.
Have you been to the Middle East personally?
Yeah, I've been to Israel twice.
What was your impression of the country?
I loved it. It was if you like Beverly Hills, if you like Manhattan, if you like Jewish civilization, then you're going to love Israel. Like Israel is a very Jewish state, and so it has many of the virtues and many of the vices that you would expect in a high concentration of Jews. But there's a vibrant press, vibrant media. There's a lot of freedom to speak your mind, and Jews are producing great books and great works of art. They're producing technological innovations. They're flourishing, and every year the separation between them and the Arab Islamic states that surround them becomes more and more apparent.
Did you get a chance? So you got a chance. You listened to the interview that Charles Lincoln did on my side about life in Beverly Hills. Wait, what was your thoughts on? It was an interview, actually. It was a monologue that Charles did.
Yeah, I heard his monologue, and I have a lot of sympathy for what he had to say. You sometimes get immigrant groups that come to the United States and try to fit in. And then you have immigrant groups that come to the United States and don't try to fit in. So he was complaining about Persians who would come to Beverly Hills and build these big mansions, mansionization it's called, these monstrosities from a Native American, from a traditional American point of view, these huge buildings, huge homes that don't fit in with the architecture and their surroundings. So I think that's accurate. There are Persians who care to be good neighbors and to fit in with their neighbors, and there are Persians who don't care to be good neighbors and to fit in. And so I think he was putting his finger on a problem. It's something that I've written about quite a bit, and how it's usually not talked about as an example of ethnic tension, but it is fundamentally an ethnic religious divide. Traditional Jews tend to have large families, and so they want bigger homes, and often these bigger homes don't fit in architecturally and with the sense of the community. So it is a traditional Jewish or Middle Eastern versus American divide. So I've touched on this and written about it several times on my blog, but I belong to the Orthodox Jewish community. There is a limit to how much I'm gonna bash my own community. I'll make my criticisms here and there, but in the final analysis, I'm an Orthodox Jew who is loyal to the Orthodox Jewish community. And even though I have a lot of sympathy for what Charles Edward Lincoln was saying, I don't devote my website to promoting criticisms of Jews. I'll do a moderate amount of criticism of my group.
You'll leave that to Kevin McDonald.
Yeah, I'll leave that to Kevin McDonald because he's not an Orthodox Jew and he doesn't have to fit in with an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. So,
Yeah, you don't want to be. Your social status is already falling down. You don't want to be a total social pariah.
yeah, I don't need to fight every battle. There are legitimate criticisms of Jews, and sometimes I'm just too tired to make them. I don't want the trouble, the aggravation that would go with making them. Sometimes I just want to turn off my mind and do something more comfortable. I remember maybe the first 10 years that I was aware of Kevin McDonald, I just wanted to ignore it. I didn't want to wrestle with it. I had enough trouble of my own. And it's only in the past few months that I've developed the strength and the inclination to start wrestling with Kevin McDonald.
So you're saying at first you felt awkward, you were worried about the social cost of expressing sympathy for that.
Yeah, well, there are only so many battles that, one person can fight. Like I was writing about the Jewish role in the pornography industry for many years. That was like a major theme on my work on the ethnic conflicts between Jews and non-Jews in the cultural and artistic realms. And so you get tired of fighting these battles. It was not a popular thing to write about. So when I heard about Kevin McDonald, I thought, oy vey, I'm not ready to wrestle with him yet. You get tired. In the end, I belong to a particular tribe. I belong to a particular group. Its well-being is my primary consideration. And so I'm willing at times to entertain criticisms of my group and to look at other points of view and to understand the well-being of groups outside of my own and to see how they conflict with me and whether I am being intellectually honest and wanting the same thing for other people as the ethnic solidarity and self-determination that I want for my own group. But I can't do that 24/7. Most of the time I belong to a very specific tribe and I live, within that tribe looking out for its welfare. Then on occasion I'll step outside of that and entertain criticisms of my tribe.
But I mean, I get the impression that, I mean, I t my site, I mean, I talk about this stuff, but I try to keep a variety. I've noticed basically when I look over your site, every single article on your site has to do with racial issues. That's basically the impression that I get.
Yeah, well, these things go in trends, in waves. Like for 10 years, I was blogging, largely about the sex industry, and then for a while, I blogged a lot about Dennis Prager and that kind of conservative point of view. Other times I've blogged extensively about sexual abuse scandals within Orthodox Judaism, rabbinic sex abuse scandals. And then about 6 months ago, I developed the courage to finally write more openly about race, things that I had thought and felt and discussed privately before, but now I just started putting them on my blog. And so I've just allowed myself free rein because my blog is an expression of whatever I want to write about. It's not primarily a business.
I think with me, when I first got into these issues, I really wanted to focus on it. But then I guess after a while, I got kind of burnt out, so I wanted to move on to the other things. But that's how blogging works.
Yeah, exactly. We're not making big bucks, and so we basically do whatever moves us. So if you look back on the archives of my site for the year or two previous to me writing a lot about race, I was writing a lot of personal essays. That was the primary thing I was writing about. It was just personal essays. And I was writing about 12-step work and recovery from various forms of emotional addiction. Yeah, there are a lot of different waves that flow through my blog.
And what do you mean specifically by emotional addiction? Usually when people think of addiction, they think of a substance, like something like a sex addiction or addiction to alcohol or drugs. What do you mean by emotional addiction?
Well, let's take someone such as myself who is fundamentally not at ease in the world, who's fundamentally not a happy, well-balanced, well-connected, normal human being. So when you live in agony, as I have lived and many people have lived, you're constantly looking for a distraction from your pain. So some people turn to alcohol, some people turn to drugs, some people turn to the pursuit of sex, some people turn to pornography, other people numb their feelings with eating excessive amounts of food. Other people numb their feelings by watching Netflix or by getting into video games or being excessive in the amount that they exercise. So some of these are emotional addictions by, you know, working out 3 hours a day. That's how they deal with their anxiety. So, you know, whatever you have to do to distract yourself from who you are and where you are in life, and that's likely to develop into an addiction.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to that because, I have an anxiety disorder.
Right, so you probably, you know, look for ways to escape your anxiety, and I assume you find that with your artistic endeavors, with your intellectual endeavors, with your hobbies. And then you probably have some of the things that I don't know about. That's how you escape from your anxiety. So people who, you know, are ill at ease at life are looking for distractions. And then those distractions sometimes take over, become addictions.
And one thing you talk about is the importance. Well, do you talk about the importance of having a sense of belonging and being part of a group? I think that's one of the most critical things.
Yeah, like we really need other people, and particularly like someone such as myself who grew up in foster care. I didn't grow up with that normal bonding with a mother. And so perhaps some of the casual cruelty that I've exhibited and that comes naturally to me is very common among people who didn't grow up with a mother. And so, you know, all my family's in Australia. I didn't really have a family in my first 5 years of life. And so I've had to seek out a substitute family. And I've found that in Orthodox Judaism. And I also felt that same kind of community in the Los Angeles Press Club for many years. So it's very important to develop human connections. So to recover from an addiction, we need both, you know, a connection to a higher power, but we also need a connection to other people. And if we're not connected to other people, then the anxiety becomes overwhelming. And then we really, you know, we start focusing on our distractions, such as, you know, watching TV or drinking or pornography or working out or video games. And these aren't healthy. It's much healthier to get together with other people, to connect with other people, and to talk about this stuff with other people.
I think religion can provide that. I think being part of an ethnic group, you're saying that Orthodox Judaism provides that for you. You bring up the issue of white nationalism. I think a lot of white nationalists are people who have grown up lacking that. I think they've attempted to provide that, but I don't think they've done as good of a job that something like Orthodox Judaism does. So I think it is very important for people to be part of a group, whether it's a religion or an ethnic group, that where you feel a strong sense of belonging.
Yeah, and you see much less of that in racially diverse places like Los Angeles, because we tend to bond more easily with people who like ourselves. So in racially diverse places like Los Angeles, as Robert Putnam of Harvard found out in his survey work, people tend to stay inside and watch television because they're not connected to their neighbors, because their neighbors speak a different language and are of different racial groups. So the more homogeneity you can have it, the easier it is to bond with other people. And then the second thing I noticed in the white nationalist movement is that you have a lot of people who are looking to make a contribution or looking to find a place where they can have a sense of importance, and all the conventional means they've failed at. And so they've had to go to more and more edges of society to find an area where they can make a contribution, where they can play an important role. So we do have a high number of basket cases in the white nationalist movement. You know, people who have failed at life and are looking for an area where they can make a contribution.
I mean, that's probably the biggest growing. Like, I basically grew up in L.A. And I know that was probably the biggest thing I've noticed growing up. I mean, I had a lot of friends. I had friends who were Jewish or friends who were Hispanic, and the biggest difference I noticed was that those groups have a strong sense of community. If you're a white person growing, a generic white person who has no connection to, who has no ethnic identity or connection to a religious group, if you're secular, then basically growing up you basically lack that. And I see that as a major issue. And you get people, a lot of the people joining who get involved in a white nationalism, they're people who lack that. But the problem, it also attracts a lot of people with psychological problems and a lot of mentally unstable people. But I think the root cause of a lot of the mental issues is that lack of sense of belonging.
Yeah, and you can see what it's like when you go to a homogeneous place like Australia, the nation that's 90% white, and see the easy bonding, camaraderie, and mateship that exists between people when you have a nation that is just one culture and one people.
And I noticed that when I was 16, I lived in the southwest of England briefly, in a place, a city in England called, not sure if you heard of it, called Plymouth, that was about 99%.
Yes, famous.
You've been there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about 99% English at the time, and I noticed that there was I wasn't able to go to school there because I didn't have permanent residency, but I noticed a much stronger sense of community and social trust. Like, you can go to a place as a stranger, and people will sort of treat you differently. Well, if in Southern California, which is very diverse, people are there's very low social trust. People are cold and distanced towards you if they don't know you.
Yeah. So it's an amazing experience when you go to somewhere that's homogeneous, like a Plymouth, England, or an Australia, or even Oregon. Like Oregon is an overwhelmingly white place, and it's just so pleasant to be there. People are so nice. There's very little social dysfunction, very little crime, very little litter. You know, it's just very white and very pleasant. And America used to be like that, and it can be like that again.
Was it, how was it like where you grew up in Northern California? Was that, would you say it's more like that or more like Southern California?
So I grew up in Australia 9 of my first 11 years, then I moved to the Napa Valley, and that was a dominantly white area. It was probably 80-90% white. And also I grew up in a very strongly Seventh-day Adventist college campus, college community. And so religion can provide a bond for people even when they're of different races. So that feeling of community was very strong, and it was to recapture a feeling of community that was one reason that led my religious search and that led me to converting to Orthodox Judaism.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. I had a friend who took me to a Christian club, and the Christian club, it was extremely racially diverse. There was a Korean guy, a black guy, a Mexican guy, but despite that, there was still a strong, there was a, you could sense there was a strong sense of belonging and community. So I think religion can provide that as well, even if there's people of different ethnic backgrounds.
Yeah, and also if you're in a profession, like a profession is a typical way that people bond, particularly men.
Some jobs, not, I guess there's plenty of jobs where people hate each other, but there's some professions where there's a strong sense of camaraderie.
Yeah, like a profession, not just a job. A profession is different from a job. So a profession is something like writing. If you're a part of a writers group or a press club, it's a strong sense of bonding. If you're a part of professional artistic association, you know, you work in Hollywood, or you're a working painter who makes his living by that, and you know, you can bond with other people who are similarly skilled and have similar passions. That's also a great way to connect with people.
And yeah, I've noticed that to a degree with the arts, because I've been involved with the arts. If you have a com, definitely if you have a common interest.
Yeah, so if you have a calling, whether it's artistic, whether it's writing or acting or dance, or if you're an Alexander Technique teacher, or if you're a marriage and family therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a podiatrist, a pediatrician, these callings are also a good way to bond with your peers.
Yeah, because we touched on this on a previous show, and this is not talked about enough, but I think a lot of problems we have in society, psychological problems, crime. We also talked about people who do like school shootings, workplace shootings. I think a lot of these different pathologies and societal problems trace back to people who grew up with a lack belonging.
Yeah, a lack of human connection. And that is for myself. The less human connection I have, the more strange I become in both my thinking and in my behavior. While when I'm connected to people, it just calms my whole system down, and I start behaving, acting, and even thinking normally, and wanting the same things that the people around me want.
But the other side of it, if you're part of a if you're part of a community like Orthodox Judaism, you also have to sacrifice some of your personal freedoms that you're forced to conform to the values of that community. So you do have to sacrifice some of your own personal freedoms. But would you say it's a trade-off you have to decide whether it's worth making? Some people don't want, some people choose not to be involved in a community like that because they don't want to have to conform.
Yeah, there's a trade-off there. There's always a trade-off between community and freedom. There's no two ways about it. But there are ways to manage it. For instance, if you simply belong to a community like Orthodox Judaism is primarily based on common rituals of behavior. You go along with the rituals and the expected behavior of the community, and it leaves you intellectually free to explore your interests so long as you don't try to take down the essential principles of your group. So there are a lot of ways that you can simply behave like other people while maintaining your intellectual freedom.
Yes, and I would, back to a kind of sillier topic, I like this post you have about where's my movie studio and why you don't have your media company.
Yeah, it was just a silly post, but making the sarcastic point that now I've converted to Orthodox Judaism, I want my own media company, because even though it's only a very tiny number of Jews who have their own media company, still, when you look at media companies, they are disproportionately owned and operated by Jews. So it's an area where we're highly influential. And it was something that the Nazis were particularly not happy with, that the Jews had risen to the top of so much of German society, whether it's in the arts or in the legal profession or in the medical profession. And so even though Jews were only 1% of Germany's population at the time, there was something like 25% of the elites in various categories. So, the Nazis were reacting to that. And I was just thinking out loud, what if 1,000 non-Jewish Germans moved to Israel and started operating most of the important newspapers, television stations, and television production companies, and theater companies? Jews would not like that, to have this alien group in their midst providing news, entertainment, and culture that was contrary to the Jewish tradition. So I can understand why non-Jews would look askance when Jews dominate the cultural levers and cultural companies of their land.
And you also have a post, this is from back in early December, from a guy, Are Jews White, by this guy named Chris the Goy.
Yeah, I don't remember it specifically, but it's a great question. Are Jews white? And currently in America, most Jews do not regard themselves as white. They regard themselves as Jewish. Yet in a different time in America, Jews did regard themselves as white. So whether or not Jews regard themselves as white depends on what's in it for the Jews. Like in our current multicultural, multiracial society, you get more points for not being white. Therefore, it's in Jews' interests and, say, Armenians' interests and Iranians' interests who are in America to not identify as white. But, say, prior to the civil rights era, it was in Jews' interest to identify as white, and so Jews did identify as white. And Jews actually got along much better and prospered much more in the South prior to the Civil Rights Revolution because they did identify as white. They did go along with Southern norms. There was no Jewish abolitionist in the South. There were no Jews calling for the end of slavery prior to the Civil War. Non-Jews, like Christians, would find a basis in biblical text for why slavery was ordained by God and was a good thing. And basically up to the Civil Rights era in the 1960s, Jews in the South supported segregation, and prior to the Civil War, they supported slavery. They identified as white, they were accepted as white, and they got along better with the Gentiles around them than they did in the North. So society can set up a country where you get points for not identifying with the majority population, or where you get incentives for identifying with the majority population. And so right now, if we set up incentives in a certain way, Latinos could identify as white and vote for the white party, which is Republican. But the way things are currently situated, Jews, Latinos get points and have more incentive to not identify as white. So I would like a white America with a big tent where Jews and Latinos would have an incentive to identify with the white majority.
But the thing with Latinos, there's Latinos of Spanish descent and Latinos of Indian descent. There's both.
Yeah, like the little brown ones. The ones who are like 5 foot tall and, will not look white in a million years. They do not look white, but plenty of Latinos who are of European ancestry do look white and would be completely assimilable to the white majority. But the problem is we give them incentives for not identifying as white and for creating a more diverse and fractious society, which is a bad thing for the United States and a very bad thing for the white majority.
So you're saying you'd like to see a sort of a big tent, as
Yeah,
it
I'd like to
were.
see a big tent where people, where Jews have given incentives for identifying as white and for identifying as Americans, and making that their key identity. Instead, right now, we give groups such as Jews points and incentives for identifying as a separate group, a separate people apart from whites, and pursuing their own interests, often completely inimical to the interests of the majority white population. So through the use of criticism and through the use of stigma, we can guide groups in how they behave. So that's why I don't think it's necessary for a white America to be 100% white. It could be 80% white and be in a great place, as long as it gave very strong directives, very strong criticism and stigma to the non-white 20% that they are expected to behave in accordance with white norms. These things depend on the behavior of Jews and whether they are a blessing to the people around them or whether they are a nuisance to the people around them. So it's not just that, Jews are God's chosen people, and anyone who criticizes Jews is criticizing God and going up against the creator of the universe. It's different groups often have very different interests, and depending on how Jews behave, that has a big effect on how they are regarded by the non-Jews around them.
And I can basically to summarize it all, I gotta say, you have to must have been in a really awkward position.
Like I try to see things from both sides. I will throw in my lot with Orthodox Jews, and whatever their fate is, I'll go into the gas chambers with them.
But I see this sort of theme. What I notice of you is there's a theme of almost, if you could say, contradiction in your life. You have the pornography versus the religion and your social conservatism, your moral conservative views. But you also have the theme of Judaism versus white nationalism. I notice this theme in throughout your life of things that are in conflict with each other. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. I'm interested in opposites. If I really get into one thing, such as, say, Judaism, then very quickly I become interested in its opposites, such as Nazism or secular humanism or pornography. These are things completely contrary to Orthodox Judaism. But yeah, I guess opposites, and understanding where different people are coming from, is something that interests me.
Yeah, because if people, it's extremely boring when people totally agree. I think you need conflicts are very create very interesting topics. I think there was a I forget who said that, but there was a quote by a famous philosopher that said, "Great men are full of contradictions."
Yeah, and it's also a personality type. Like I'm a mismatcher. I see what, doesn't match up. And on the one hand, that makes for an unhappy life because you don't tend to connect normally with other people. On the other hand, it does produce this distinctive style of thinking that you allude to.
Yeah, so Luke, it's been a really great show. I just want to thank you for just being on yet another one of I guess this is sort of I guess you're now kind of a regular on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Robert. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks again. That's all we have. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.